Who remembers the Hebrew national slogan from, I would say, late 80s? Which is? We answer to a higher authority. Which I think was part of a trend in the 80s and 90s and into the aughts that kosher food was healthier. Which is an interesting premise that has no basis in fact and can be adequately demonstrated by the number of morbidly obese, very orthodox people that exist. And if you ever go to a very serious kosher meat restaurant and watch them, it's somewhat like an IHOP. When you get in there, you'll see that a lot of people seem very poorly in shape, and it indicates to you that this restaurant is probably not good for your health. Which goes to an interesting point. We often think that our laws are morally superior and cultivate a different kind of human being. To an extent, that's true. And it goes hand in hand with a concept that we struggled with as we were preparing Freedom Song here, and Beit Tshuva and other Jewish drug and alcohol rehabilitation centers struggle with, that there aren't Jewish alcoholics, that somehow we have perfected our sensibilities and our desires and our lusts, and that kashrut and sexual laws and other religious ritual makes us immune or inured to certain temptations. That is not true. And in fact, it's so clear to our sages that Nachmanides, speaking of the very beginning of this week's parasha, he is a rabbi of 13th century Spain, began to create a concept called a Naval Birshut HaTorah, and I want to go into that a little with you. The reason you have the opening of the parasha that one should be holy is that since the Torah has warned against, and does somewhat in this parasha itself, forbidden sexual relations and forbidden foods, while simultaneously permitting relations with one's wife and eating milk, meat, and wine, a lustful person can find a place to wallow in promiscuity, or he's really not talking about promiscuity as much as over-sexualization, with his wife or wives, although by his era there weren't really multiple marriages in the north, and be one of the guzzlers of wine or a glutton of meat, and converse at will about any licentious things. There's no prohibition about saying and speaking of and doing certain licentious things. You can be, and I think this is the translation, a hedonist, or a no-good-nick, or a ruffian, or a rake would be a good word for it, with the Torah's permission, a naval birshut haTorah, that you exist within the confines of Torah's prohibitions, but still are a boor. Therefore, after enumerating the things that it forbids entirely throughout Torah, but especially in Leviticus, Torah simply says, be holy. Constrain yourself even also in things that are permitted. We are people of appetites and people of compulsions and addictions, whether, as we discussed several Thursdays ago at Freedom Songs Performance, whether they be drugs, alcohol, gambling, sexual, internet. One of my advisors at Beit Tshuva used to say, we're all addicted to low-grade misery. Some people are addicted to being in control. We're in control of others. There's so many compulsions we have just about the way we regulate our lives that Judaism has nothing to speak on. I do personally believe that one of the things that Jewish ritual law and prohibition and restriction, for example, Shabbat law, teaches us is a certain amount of delayed gratification and the power of the executive function in one's mind. And Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks also suggests this, that a lot of Jewish law promotes stronger executive function, stronger capacity to delay gratification, but not exclusively. I mean, Jews, I know plenty of gluttons among Jews. I know plenty of Jews who smoke. There are many things that one does that have nothing, no bearing upon your Judaism. And so we are all still fundamentally creatures of appetites. We are incarnate. We have an id, what we call in Judaism really our yetzer hara, the desire for destruction and sexual power and consumption, and rages, and appetites. And for most of us, except for the sociopath, that coexists with a great deal of shame and occasionally embarrassment, that we live with our gut pained about how much we ate last night, or the lusts we feel in our heart for people we see on the street, or the desires we have for things on the internet that are not for us, whether it be shopping, or pornography, or other addictions, even something compulsive as Facebook. That we exist with a great deal of appetite and even overlaying that appetite a great deal of shame about the way we're created, things about which we cannot easily do otherwise, and that shame itself paralyzes us from making changes. That we have a litany in our heads, I know I do, but I speak with enough people to know that it's pretty common, of all of our faults and all of our flaws, manifold and many, and powerful and deep as they may be. And the only way to escape is to somehow diffuse, or at least let the air out of the shame a bit. There's a mitzvah in the parasha that you should not go about as a talebearer, nor allow and permit a talebearer. One of the mitzvot that would fall under the rubric, the larger rubric of lashon hara, poor speech, poor misuse of one's tongue. And a man came to see Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who was one of the Chabad lineage of rabbis, and proceeded to portray himself as a villain of the worst sort one can imagine. He described, sort of in a confessional, all the dark and dirty deeds he would do and all the things he felt in his heart and all the cruelty he wished to inflict, as we all have those pieces in our fractured soul. And after describing at great length his moral and spiritual deficiencies and presumably all of his misdeeds and misbehaviors, he begged the Rebbe to help him overcome his poor and evil character. And the Rebbe said, "Surely you know that among our gravest sins, among the worst transgression in Judaism, is lashon hara, which we might call talebearing, as in the case of this week's parasha." And the Rebbe said, "Nowhere to my knowledge does it say that it's permissible to speak lashon hara, even about oneself." I've had people come into my office and describe that situation. "I'm so decrepit, I'm so low, I'm so base." We all feel base at some level. We all feel low by moments, or at least in pieces. And sometimes the most important thing I can do as a rabbi, or one could do as a friend, is to share the vulnerability of acknowledging that I feel that way too. That I, frankly, have moments of thinking of throwing my children off a bridge. I'd never done it, at least not a very tall bridge. But we all struggle with it. There's some external perception of how we're supposed to be and some level of perfection or ideal or ultimate goodness that no human being can actually reach, that's totally unattainable. I think it was Thoreau who said, no, Emerson, that our reach should exceed our grasp, else what's a heaven for? That we all, what? Browning? Thank you, you're right. I was close in era, I think. But
Contemporary,
yeah. I got the era right. Browning said, our reach should exceed our grasp. And it always does. Perfection is asymptotic. We'll never attain it. But in the space between our appetites and our desires and the person we aspire to be, we can be crippled with shame, as I've said. And that's no good either. Living a life where you just dwell on the things you don't do and feel bad about who you really are, and are afraid to admit your authentic self with all of its weaknesses and flaws, is no life either. It's a life of pain and despair and loneliness, but also no way to get better. So we also have a wonderful mitzvah in this week's parasha that says you should certainly and surely rebuke your fellow. That it's a mitzvah to raise to one's attention all of one's deficits. The problem is, I think, at its root, or at its most simple understanding, that could exacerbate the problem. That pointing out to people what they're doing wrong and then offering them advice about how to solve it is very bad. No one's going to accept that advice. No one wants to be told how to do things. At best, we can inspire people to find the resources within themselves. So our sages have said that rebuke is repeated twice. It says, ocheach tochiach, which is actually just a verbal form called the absolute imperative, that you certainly must is the way Hebrew intends that. But anytime it's repeated twice, our sages like to make play and midrash on that. And it says that rebuke, those words are repeated twice because the first person you should rebuke is yourself. And I might expand that to suggest that the real value of a psychotherapist or a loving doctor or a teacher or a rabbi is a certain kind of camaraderie and authenticity and vulnerability that they can offer. That if they share with you what you're going is not so uncommon, I myself have dealt with it, and to be frank, I've never resolved it. I may be a few steps ahead of you on the path, but I still to this day struggle with that compulsion or that unresolved appetite. And our sages say that the power of that is so immense. There's a quote that's often used but has no clear root or antecedent. It says that words that come from the heart enter the heart. And that's the power of real friendship and love, is that you can say to a person, I've been there, I am there, I'm only a few steps ahead of you in that darkness, and I've tried this way and I've tried that way and they didn't work, but hold hands with me and we'll get through it together. And that power of vulnerability and solidarity is what gets people past the shame and allows them not to be advised, but to find the resources and the wherewithal within them. We're told in Pirkei Avot that you shouldn't judge another until you stood in his place. The classic, don't judge anyone until you've walked a mile in their moccasins. And Shneur Zalman of Liadi says that the only person you can truly stand in whose place you could truly stand is yourself. That means you're probably about the only person you can actually judge. Let other people work out on their own. Be clear about your faults. Share the vulnerability with them, and through that process, allow them to follow you and to hold hands with you and to work together. One of the most beautiful mitzvot we get is in this week's parasha. The verse ends, "Ahavta l're'echa kamocha ani Adonai." Love your neighbor, love your fellow person as yourself. As we were talking in the little text study I gave at the very beginning of this week's service, this morning service, one of the most powerful mitzvot for a rabbi, for a human, the hardest mitzvah, is what you might call Ahavat Yisrael. We've talked about it as we've prepared mission statement for our school. To love another Jew, to love other people, to be loved, to allow oneself to be loved. It's not easy. It's not easy to let in. But Rabbi Akiva says that is the central principle of Torah, to love your fellow as yourself. And to be open, one-on-one, with the things you struggle with, to make real vulnerability and authenticity, to step beyond your flaws and not let them tie you down or paralyze you, but to make common cause against the foe of complacency and against the foe of fear and against the foe of shame and embarrassment.